55 members of Congress, Democratic and Republicans, and judges, Supreme Court judges, saying this man needs to be fit for your retrial. And here us as taxpayers have been paying for this for 40 years because there's a few bad apples out there that want to see Leonard stay and rot and die in prison. We're only human, you know. When Leonard got convicted of the crime that they framed him for, it was actually only a 7-year sentence, and they gave him a 30-year sentence on each one. Well, that's violations there. All through the 40 years they've been violating this man, the retired FBI Association has been harassing him, sending him letters, which is illegal. They've been buying his website names up, linking him to the No Parole Peltier, which is illegal.
We have to go.
Violated his rights as an artist 4 months ago. So, I mean, it's going 40 years, and they're violating this man's rights, and us taxpayers are paying for this.
Thank you so much, Chauncey. We have to end now, but this continues. When we say justice for Leonard Peltier, we're talking about justice for everyone, because we are not free as long as we are keeping political prisoners behind bars and attempting to silence them. This has been Air Cascadia for Monday, March 7th, 2016. Kate Welch engineered the show today. Thanks, Kate. Kathleen Stevenson's the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts. Know your rights. Take a stand. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned.
Tune into KBOO on Tuesday, March 8th from midnight to midnight as we celebrate International Women's Day with 24 hours of programming produced, hosted, and engineered by women. There will be live music, public affairs with a feminist focus, and female DJs playing all kinds of music to celebrate the creativity, variety, and zeal of the women of the world. Again, that's Tuesday, March 8th, from midnight to midnight, here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Good morning. This is Kathleen Stevenson for KBOO Public Affairs. Locus Focus is off today, and I'm pleased to have in the studio with me Robert McChesney and John Nichols, who are in Portland today to talk about the ideas in their new book, People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy. Welcome, Bob and John. Thanks very much for coming into KBOO today.
We're delighted to be here.
Pleasure to be here.
And John and Bob will be at Powell's City of Books on Burnside tonight at 7:30 p.m. Robert, or Bob McChesney, is a professor at the University of Illinois. He is the author or editor of 23 books. John Nichols is the Nation Magazine's national affairs correspondent, a contributing writer for The Progressive, and associate editor of the Capital Times. You say that we are on the verge of the end of work as we know it, with rapid advances in technology eliminating millions of jobs and displacing workers. Can you explain how you see this happening?
Yeah, basically, when computers came along, the digital revolution began in World War II. It almost immediately, engineers and people in business and people in labor realized that this could replace a lot of human labor, like no other technology ever had, because artificial intelligence could do stuff that a mere machine that had to be led by another human couldn't do. And as early as 1946, Fortune magazine was projecting the end of workers, certainly in factories. In the 1960s, we had an enormous hysteria about automation and all the jobs that would be lost and no one would have work. And now we look back at that, and it's almost laughable. They thought computers could replace human labor. But in the intervening 50 years now, and what we write about, especially in the last few years, we've seen such a quantum leap, I mean, and literally a quantum leap, in the order of magnitude of computer power and its growth, that we're now poised, we're in the midst, actually, the beginning of a period in which computers can much less expensively and more efficiently do most of what human beings do. We're beginning to see it, and it's going to hit heavily in the next 5 or 10 years. The way most people see it tangibly is something like driverless cars, which we can do now. That was something that was thought impossible a decade ago. Now it's actually a pretty simple problem. They've got a few things to iron out, mostly dealing with bad human drivers who screw everything up. But you know, once you get something like driverless cars, Kathleen, that's the number one job for most American men. That's the number one job American men do, is drive vehicles of one kind or another, be it truck, bus, cab, car. Basically, once you go driverless, everything's driverless. You get rid of humans pretty much. You've just wiped out the number one job for American men. Well, that's a big impact.
Right. And it's not just manual labor jobs. It's not just service jobs. Talk about the range of the jobs.
You've read the book. Thank you. And this is the important thing to understand, because I think an awful lot of people imagine that the way out of this is education. That's a part of it. Education is always vital. But one of the things you have to understand is that many jobs for which people do a lot of preparation and, in fact, have gotten a lot of education are now threatened by these changes. Amazingly enough, architects are very much threatened. And, in fact, we've seen a lot of loss of jobs in that area. We've also seen a tremendous loss of jobs in a whole host of other industries, which you might not imagine. And some of these are, you know, manufacturing jobs, automation and robots, which are just booming right now, literally hundreds and hundreds of thousands of them being bought by major corporations to replace people. As simple as that. Of course, they can come into a fast food restaurant, make sandwiches, take orders, you know, all sorts of structural stuff there. The digital technology makes that very possible. But also in areas that are a little bit, you know, up that ladder. Think about, I'll give you a very good example. Because it's something that's already happened, and that's important for people to understand, wrap their head around this. In 1988, Kodak, which is a company everybody knows, Kodak had 145,000 employees around the U.S. They literally sustained several major cities. Some of them worked in manufacturing. Others worked in processing. They did all kinds of stuff. It was actually rather sophisticated work. They also had a fabulous research area that developed much of the digital technology for how we take pictures on phones. You took our picture out in front of KBOO a few minutes ago.
Right.
The roots of that were there. Well, here's the interesting thing. That technology was picked up by a lot of other folks, including one company, Instagram. And if you, we know lots of people that use Instagram a lot. Well, there was an interesting intersection of these two companies in 2012. Kodak went bankrupt. Literally, one of the biggest, oldest companies in America went bankrupt. It was restructured as a tiny fraction of what it was. This is a company, 145,000 people. Instagram, which had actually played a huge role in diminishing Kodak, right, in literally taking that space, it was purchased by Facebook. That's how our big companies grow now. They don't grow by innovating. They grow by buying somebody else who innovated and then putting it in so they don't have competition. Well, they had to release the job figures for Instagram when it was purchased for over $1 billion. They had 13 employees. So you took all of that Kodak, right? All that stuff. Now you got 13 employees. You say, well, what happened? What happened? This is the critical thing to understand. In this digital future that we are now in, this future that we are living, we are losing a lot of traditional jobs, but they aren't being replaced by new jobs. What's interesting about it is we're doing the work now. We process the photos on our phones, and that's fine. That's wonderful. No reason not to like that technology. But understand this. What are we going to do? What comes next in that process? And here's the interesting thing. We're still producing something of value. We're still actually, you know, feeding money into the chain, but it's going to these tiny numbers of elites who are getting massively richer, monopolizing these companies more and more. And what we're being told is, you know, we have to cobble together an existence. Maybe we'll drive an Uber car. Maybe we'll turn a part of our house over to Airbnb. Maybe we'll be doing some other gig and stuff like that. Trying to piece together a day of work, trying to get enough resources to get by. In this future, if we keep working ourselves to the bone, trying to keep adjusting to fewer and fewer jobs, we're going to be worn out. We're not going to have as much money, but very, very wealthy people are going to be dramatically richer. So we see this is the time to intervene. People at every level on the economic chain, whether you're, you know, in a very low-paid, tough job where you should get $15 an hour, you need a lot of changes there, you need to be involved in this because you don't want to be automated out of that. But middle class workers, working class people, they've got a big part of this, because if we don't start to hoop ourselves together and get serious about what's coming at us, they're going to work us harder than we have ever been worked for less pay, and in a more desperate situation where ultimately we're going to end up turning on one another. We're going to start to blame immigrants. We're going to start to blame anybody, you know, who Donald Trump has already talked about. That's going to be our future, and we shouldn't want that as our future.
What is the awareness that you found about, you mentioned, Robert, you mentioned that in the 60s there was this awareness of the possible automation of a lot of jobs and people were quite frightened. What's the awareness of this right now?
Well, I think it declined since the 60s. In fact, we chronicle how the press coverage declined every decade fairly sharply from the 60s to the present. I think right now it's coming back. I mean, one of the things that's striking in doing the research for this book was reading the business literature, the engineering literature. This is an enormous issue in business communities. To give a couple of stories about this, the CEO of one of the largest industrial firms in the world, a German company, last year in a private meeting, was asked about automation. And this person's company employs several hundred thousand workers at union jobs at really good standard of living in Germany and around the world. And he said, when asked, that they had the technology already to completely automate all their factories. And he said, the reason we're not doing this right now is basically political, because if we do that, and this is a direct quote, the middle class in Germany will burn. That was his quote. Mm-hmm. The backbone of the modern German economy would collapse this prestigious company. And then when we looked at the DARPA, which is the Defense Advanced Research Projects Group, which created the internet to a large extent, bankrolled the research in the 60s and 70s that developed the internet protocol. And they still are alive and well. And their crucial job is doing high-tech, innovative digital research and drawing in all the top scientists and encouraging them to work in certain areas. For the last 10 years, they've had a special project in robotics. And automation and artificial intelligence. And the person who ran that program left after a decade, and he wrote an article in a journal that came out last year. And he said that what we're about, he described some of what they were doing, and it was almost impossible to believe. Not hypothetical, we might do this 20 years from now, but this is what we're working on right now. It's just about to come on. And he said that what humanity is entering right now with the internet and the digital revolution isn't like a comparison to, say, the printing press, which everyone acknowledges changed human history, or the alphabet, or speech, that which distinguishes us from other primates. This is bigger than that. He said this is comparable to what's called the Cambrian explosion. The Cambrian explosion is that period 540 million years ago, when in a 20 million year period, life went from single cell organisms, which they'd been for like 500 million years, to this explosion of life underwater that led to eventually to dinosaurs, to mammals, to us. And it took place, and it wasn't a gradual rise over a billion years, it was this explosion. And that was the period in which people were able to see vision emerge, things like that. He said, that's what's going to happen to humanity in the next 20, 30 years. We're going to have a Cambrian explosion. He said, the only thing we know for sure is that most jobs are going to be replaceable very quickly. There's really not going to be a justification for having these jobs because they can be so much done so much less expensively. Now, in some scenarios, in fact, most people thought traditionally, when you have technology that has this capacity, so that people don't have to work anymore. This was actually one time a utopia. This is great. People don't have to go to a coal mine, work in an office. Everyone can have a great life where everything, their needs are met thanks to technology, and everyone can then have the life of leisure that once only enjoyed by the affluent, where you can cultivate the arts, you can play music, you can spend time with your loved ones, you can just have this wonderful life. And the tragedy, and what we write about in the book, is that unfortunately in a capitalist context, in the context of the way our economy works, it doesn't produce that. Instead, what we're seeing, instead of greater affluence, greater social security, we're seeing right now, especially for young people, tremendous insecurity, a weakening labor market, declining jobs, salaries, conditions, no future to speak of. And this really gets to the nub of the book, which is that what we need to do is have a fundamental democratization of our society to address how do we democratize our economy? How do we make it so these technologies don't imprison us, but actually liberate us? And that's the moment we're at politically and historically.
Right.
If I can just add quickly that everything that Bob said, if you listen to it, he was talking about scholarly journals, you know, tech groups, CEOs. As we produced this book, we kind of went, you know, kind of under the surface of our global economy. We attended conferences in Europe with top CEOs. We've lectured at Google. We've been all over. And the thing is that we became part of a global conversation about this that is incredibly elite, that powerful people talk about this all the time. And in fact, Eric Schmidt of Google, when he appeared in Davos a couple of years ago, literally said, you know, this is the big issue of the next 20 or 30 years.
The keynote address at Davos.
And he said, the next 20, 30 years, this is what we're going to be talking about. How are we going to find jobs for people? Because this is going to be a massive social shift. Oxford, where they've studied this, other major universities, they talk about losing, you know, 40 to 50% of existing jobs in the foreseeable future. These changes are coming fast and now. And what shocked, terrified, awoke us was the reality that this conversation was going on at a certain level and the rest of humanity was not a part of it. We were literally looking at it from afar. And essentially what we're told to think about technology is you need the next iPhone, right? That's you get the next iPhone, get iPhone 6. What we came away with was a sense of a fundamental disconnect between where the elites are talking and the future they see coming at us very, very rapidly and where the great mass of humanity is. That disconnect is not a technological disconnect. It's not even an economic disconnect. It is a democracy disconnect because these people, these elites believe they will make all the decisions about it and that maybe they'll sort it out, maybe they'll develop an app or something, right? But we haven't brought the people into it. And that's why our title is People Get Ready. We are literally saying, folks, we can't be on the sidelines of this debate.
Right. And also in the title is the phrase citizenless democracy,
yes.
Which is that what you just described?
Yeah, we have a crisis state with our democracy. And we should, you know, we're in the midst of this great theater, which is a presidential race. I've covered every presidential race since I was a little kid. I've covered elections in 25 countries around the world. I cover politics for a living. I'm pretty good at this. I actually get it. And I can tell you that this is the worst theater possible, what's going on. This has nothing to do with reality. We are literally facing a presidential race in America right now where they're talking about the male endowments of Donald Trump and Marco Rubio. I mean, just unbelievably absurd stuff. And the fact of the matter is that there are, everything that we're concerned about that Bob and I are writing about is reflected onto this race, but not talked about by the candidates very much and not talked about by the media at all. And that is, why are both parties kind of blowing up? Mm-hmm. Why did a 74-year-old Democratic socialist from Vermont, you know, upset the trajectory of the former Secretary of State of the United States? You know, I mean, this incredible, you know, disconnect there. Why is Bernie Sanders doing as well as he's doing, especially with young people? Why is Donald Trump literally blowing up the entire Republican establishment, not with young people, but with older folks? What brings us together? You know, if you watch our news, you would think it's just everything's going crazy. It's really weird. Trump is this, and there's that, you know, Sanders, he's interesting in that, you know, but there's like what they don't put together, they don't see the intersection here. That 18-year-old kid, 19-year-old kid who's at a Bernie Sanders rally, that young adult is concerned about his or her future. deeply concerned about whether she can have a job and really anything akin to what her parents or grandparents had, and genuinely worried about not just student debt, but literally everything that comes beyond it. These young people grew up marinated in this technology. They know its potential, and they're concerned, right? So Bernie Sanders' slogan is, a future you can believe in. Donald Trump's slogan is, make America great again. That 58-year-old guy who's been laid off a couple times and is now, you know, working in a warehouse, who's at his rally, looking at all this reality and saying, I don't know if I can make it to my retirement. And so they want to go back. They want to blame somebody else. Sanders saying, let's hoop ourselves together and try and take this thing on. Bottom line is, the only way to explain the volatility of the 2016 presidential race is to understand the issues we're talking about. But until that understanding is there, it is a citizenless democracy. It isn't just that we have such low voter turnout in America. It's also that citizens are told certain issues are off the table. You can't talk about holding bankers to account for crashing our economy. You can't really talk about trade deals and stuff like that, because that's just too complicated, TPP, everything like that. We can't talk about taxing the rich, because you really don't, quote unquote, understand how that all works. We're told everything that matters to our future is off the table. Well, in that circumstance, democracy becomes a big theater. You can listen to Donald Trump spout, but it doesn't become real. What we're arguing is, we have a very, very short amount of time in which to make democracy real, to put the big issues on the table, to get people talking about them, and to get people voting on them. And what they should be voting for is not just a political reality. They should be voting for an economic reality. We have a right to, as citizens, as a vast majority of people in this country, we have a right to shape an economy where technological, digital changes, automation, where these things benefit us rather than oppress us.
Right, right. Let me tell people again, that was John Nichols. Also here with me is Robert McChesney. We're talking about their new book, People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy. And they will be at Powell's on Burnside tonight at 7:30. And let's get into how do we combat this? How do we democratize all these things, the economy, journalism, all these areas that you write about in this book? Bob, do you want to start?
The way we frame it is that to understand democracy, it's a much more complex thing than just having the right to vote. Just giving everyone the right to vote is actually on its own very relatively meaningless. What you need is what's called a democratic infrastructure that makes it possible for people to really participate effectively and not just superficially. And what do we mean by democratic infrastructure? It's things like having a credible news media system that draws people into public life, makes them aware of issues, keeps people in power accountable, having quality education for everyone, not just wealthy people, so people have an access to great information. Education. It means also things like not having too much inequality. Inequality is a cancer for self-government and democracy. Militarism is a cancer for self-government. Corruption is a cancer for self-government. So there's a bunch of core things that virtually all political scientists know, about 6 to 10, that are sort of the foundations of having a vibrant, healthy democracy. If you look at the countries that are rated the most democratic in the world by virtually all measures, they're countries that have much less inequality than, they have very little equality compared to us. They don't have much militarism. They don't have corrupt governance. They have vibrant news media. They have free education through college. There's a number of things you just do. And ironically, the United States really believes in this. We actually developed a lot of this idea of democratic infrastructure in the 1940s, because Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Henry Wallace, the president and vice president, as they were fighting World War II against fascism, they were obsessed with what can we do in America to make sure fascism never returns. And they came to the belief that fascism was really when this democratic infrastructure was destroyed. So if you could build it up and have a vibrant, credible democratic system, then when massive unemployment came along and dislocation, the people could actually solve the problem. You wouldn't resort to fascism and war and all this associated with it. We think that's right. We think they're absolutely right. We think the lessons of history is that's what we need to do now. So people say, what do we do now? Well, the one thing we know for sure is the more we strengthen democratic institutions and democratic involvement, the more likely we are to get an answer that works for all of us. And if we don't do that, if we have a citizenless democracy like we have now, where most people don't vote and they're sort of led around and by an inane news media, we're not going to get results. We're going to get what John was describing, elites making decisions behind closed doors and us discussing hand size of politicians.
Yeah. And if I can, this is starting to get a little depressing, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
It shouldn't be.
All right.
Not depressed.
Here's the good news. There's really good news in this. We have a chapter in the book on the reality of what happens when you have massive technological change, when you have massive economic change, when everything is in shift. It focuses people. They begin to look up from their day to day because they know that their future is going to be radically different and they've got to get involved. And what we would argue is that we're in a fabulous moment right now. We are in an epic political moment, not reflected in our politics all that often, except we think sometimes with Bernie Sanders, not reflected in our media, except on KBOO. But this is a big deal. What's going on? We should pause and understand. We have a $15 in a union movement, a movement to really raise wages to end poverty wages. We have a Black Lives Matter movement to say, look, we have got to end, you know, this all of these structural, fundamentally flawed approaches to policing and incarceration, what we do to people who are not working or who have been, you know, dislocated by in our economy, and what we frankly do to people who are working but are burdened tremendously by an unjust society. We're seeing a massive climate change movement where people are saying literally the earth is burning. We've got to respond to that. We are seeing a resurgence of worker cooperatives and worker ownership across this country. We're actually seeing, although you would never know it from our media, a resurgence of the trade union movement. There are 200,000 more people in unions this year than there were last year, despite all the attacks on unions. You know, why is all this happening? The people know something's amiss. They also, that's why they're looking for, you know, political alternatives that our media tells us are way too radical, way too scary. So things are opening up, right? It's real. And this is what always happens. 200 years ago when the Industrial Revolution dislocated people all over Northern England, the initial reaction was to break the technology, literally the Luddites going in and breaking the machines. And we write a lot about that in the book. They failed. But power was so terrified by them that there were more British troops in the north of England at certain points in that period than there were fighting Napoleon. That power was so terrified that the people would rise up and push back against these radical, not technological changes so much as economic and social changes. This is what happened in the progressive era in America. You had, again, this great reaction against the end of an agrarian society, the rise of an industrial society. What happens in every one of these instances is initially people are literally freaked out and they respond with a pushback and an anger and you see politics that you don't like. Over time, they realize it's not technological change that's the problem. It's the lack of democracy. It's the lack of who is in charge. And they begin to make big demands. It's a wonderful thing that happens. In England, the Luddite movement did not succeed, but the Chartist movement, which grew out of it, demanded universal suffrage. Everybody gets to vote. Demanded the structuring of democracy so that those who won elections could actually govern. You saw the rise of the trade union movement. You saw the rise of women's rights movements, a women's suffrage movement that was incredibly radical and ultimately successful. All sorts of openings start to come. What we are saying in our book is that we're there. We are at the moment where we have to harness this energy. Nobody who's working for a $15 wage should deny the vitality of a Black Lives Matter movement. Nobody working for Black Lives Matter should deny the vitality of an immigrant rights movement. Nobody who's working on these issues should fail to recognize the necessity of a rise of a trade union movement. We must all connect on this climate change. Hoop it all together. Hoop it all together. And we use that phrase, we borrow that phrase from one of our most imperfect presidents, Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson, very flawed man, but he thought a lot about how to actually make democracy begin to develop. Martin Luther King Jr. used to say that, you know, we don't look to Jefferson for what he did in his life but we look to him for what he told us was possible. Back in 1798, when this country was blowing apart, we were in a horrible circumstance. John Adams was literally jailing his political foes, jailing journalists who asked tough questions. It was a tough time. Jefferson, as a vice president, was battling with Adams. A friend said, you know, are we ever going to get out of this? Jefferson said this wonderful thing. He said, in a matter of time, the reign of the witches will pass. People will begin to awaken to the reality that a handful of powerful people are doing bad things to us, but there are a lot more of us. And if we hoop ourselves together, we can see them off. We can actually take power. Now, Jefferson didn't fully understand what he was talking about, but we should. There are a lot more of us than there are of them. If we get into this discussion, if we understand what the elites are talking about, and we make ourselves a part of that, if we look at that table where the most powerful CEOs in the world are gathered, the people from Google, all of their, you know, compatriots at Facebook, all these billionaires, look at that table. If we walk into that room and we say, hey, look, you know, I think I'm going to pull a chair up at this table, right? I think I want to sit here too. And I want a future that's as much about me as it is about you. I want my future, not yours. You know, that's where it all changes. And so far from being overwhelmed by this, we ought to see that the trajectories of this moment are in our favor as long as we know what we're fighting about.
And the whole issue of the economy, and which you, I think you alluded to earlier as being the most difficult of all the areas to democratize, what can happen there? What can possibly happen there? We've seen the crash of 2008 and what came out of that. By hooping everyone together, what can happen with that issue?
Well, let's start with, even before we talk about technology and automation, I mean, the first part of our discussion in the book is about just the trends in capitalism in the last generation. Even if you, before you introduce artificial intelligence, you know, we're in a capitalism now that is stagnant. It's not growing quickly, declining incomes, growing inequality, incessant calls for austerity to make life more difficult for people. That's the reality of capitalism before this technology. Technology just is going to make it much more severe. So it's been a problem, a growing problem. And we've been going through this long period in which, you know, the dominant political forces have said, you know, we have to scale back the idea of democracy, that the government should serve people, and increase the idea that government should serve the rich. And if we wealthy investors are happy, they will make investments and give us all jobs and we'll all live happily ever after. Well, I think it's fair to say after four decades of that being the operating logic in the United States, or 3.5 decades, that it's run its course, that it has not worked. In fact, we see the evidence all around us. Today, we have $2 trillion of liquid capital, cash, not being invested because no one can make a buck investing money. There's just not profitable investments. We have a situation in countries around the world that are, for the first time since the Great Depression, offering negative interest rates. Basically, you're fined. You don't get interest for putting your money in the bank. You're fined if you keep it there because they want to force you to invest it even if there's no return. And this is the spawning ground of, like, the 1930s, of massive unemployment and underemployment. It's only going to get worse. And it's in this context that the mainstream collapses. They have nothing to offer. And in this country, like many of the countries in the 30s, it's highly corrupt. The politicians are on the take. We all know what a sleazy operation it is. John's described how the decision-making process is. We talk about it in the book. But it's in this context that then the discussion of what can we do about the economy moves to the center, not out of, like, well, maybe we ought to talk about it because we have nothing better to do with our time, but, you know, maybe I'd like to eat. Maybe I'd like to have a roof over my head. Maybe I don't want my children to die because they can't afford medicine. I mean, this is when we're moving to a period in which this has become fundamental and central to people's lives and to politics. And I think what we're in is that era is here. It's upon us. People might not articulate it exactly like that, but that's what we're experiencing. It's only going to increase. And I think what's hopeful here is that we're seeing immense amounts of experimentation. John described it. We talk about it in the book. You know, people aren't just sitting back doing nothing. It's not covered in our news media. So if you watch MSNBC and CNN and commercial news media, you'd have no idea any of this is taking place. But it's exciting. It tells us what's possible. But, and this is the crucial but, it's just the beginning. It shows there's promise. What's going to have to happen eventually are broad social movements that really come in and insist upon democratization of society in a way that really we haven't seen for generations in this country. That's the great process we're in. Now, when we wrote the book, and we started it a couple of years ago, and we wrote the drafts of it, you know, we followed the Sanders campaign from afar because we're both political junkies, and John covers politics for a living. But, you know, we didn't anticipate that the great pressures would emerge at the electoral side very soon. We thought the corruption of the electoral system, combined with the magnitude of these problems, that it'd probably be in the 4, 6, 8, 10 years before the electoral side would see this. I confess the speed with which the Sanders campaign exploded, and I've had a chance to witness it firsthand at some points, has surprised us. But I think it shows that, it confirms that we're sitting on top of an explosion in this country.
Mm-hmm. Just throwing on top of that, or along with that, that the challenge that we have now is that there is so little discussion of the real issues that it lends itself to very dangerous responses, really damaging and threatening responses for the whole of us. Because power actually knows, economic power knows the crisis that's coming. The question is, how does economic power continue to benefit in this circumstance? Well, the way it happens is if we blame a lot of people, right? If we find a lot of people that say, well, it's their fault. If they weren't here, everything would work fine. Or they're not working hard enough. If they would just work harder, it would be fine. You know, the fact is, if you listen to some of these political debates, you will literally hear people saying that, you know, we can't, Donald Trump said this in a debate, so we can't raise the minimum wage. That just wouldn't work. That just wouldn't work because, you know, we need people to be working harder and, you know, blah, blah. Essentially, the sub-theme of that debate was we need people to be so desperate that they'll work for any amount of money. Well, I gotta tell you, if that's where we're headed in an automation age, right, when you literally can replace just about any job, that desperation factor is going to get bigger and bigger. We will move toward an uglier and uglier politics. Now, the alternative to that is a very interesting one. The alternative to that is a recognition that, number one, we do need a social welfare state. It's a good thing. Getting health care, getting transportation, these things, that's going to help us, right? If we could take, in an age where we're dislocated a lot, if we've got these guarantees, that's really going to be helpful. Guarantees of housing, things of that nature. That, so social welfare state suddenly becomes a lot more attractive, a lot easier education. To sell education. But then here's the other thing. Why not rethink work? Why not think differently about work? Every great inventor, Tesla, Edison, every great thinker, Einstein, John Dewey, all of these people, as technology rose, they said, well, this is great. We won't have to work as much, right? Mm-hmm. We really can have much more creative and exciting and wonderful lives. We can work a little bit and the technology will see us through a lot. We're not getting any of the benefits of that vision. So, our job as authors and as thinkers to some extent is to say to people, you know those utopian demands they tell you you can't ask for? Well, they just gave you a phone where you can connect to the whole world. You can literally watch any movie or read any book on your phone. You can play any game. You can do all this other stuff. Why can't we have less work and more humanity? Why can't our lives be better? When we open up that debate in a realistic and practical sense, that changes all of our politics. And ultimately, it has the potential to change all of our economics.
I guess my first reaction to that is the kind of response that I hear from someone in my ear saying, oh, well, that will never work, that there has to be work for money. How are these people that don't work as much, how are they going to get money? So just some response to that kind of quote.
Well, that's the fundamental question. Now, we have basically two options. We can say, well, we just proceed this massive unemployment and say, well, those people must be losers if they don't have jobs because, you know, they're just lazy, obviously, and they should just work for less. And
they shouldn't have gone to architecture school.
Yeah, whatever. And that approach. And I think that approach, when you have 4% unemployment or 6% unemployment, and most people have jobs and are working hard, you understand the logic. We're in a situation where that logic doesn't work. I mean, we're under you know, for young people today in the United States, they're in the Great Depression. They're in the Great Depression now. We're not talking hypothetical. And to say, hey, 18, 21-year-old, it's your fault you don't have a great job. It's absurd when most jobs are temp work with no benefits and no security whatsoever and lousy pay. So, I mean, that notion that, well, you ought to work because it's your fault, we can park that one on the side of the road. It's gone. We can bury it. It's nothing to do with anything. The real question is, we have this ability to produce this bounty. How is it going to be determined? What's it going to do? And who's going to benefit by it? That's the great question. And it's a radical question, but these are radical times. We are at a moment in our species history that is a Cambrian explosion. We're at a moment where we're facing the prospect that within decades, no humans will have to do very much work at all. And it changed for our entire existence since we evolved out of our primate chimpanzee brothers and sisters. economic survival, material survival, has been the number one focus, that and reproducing our species, of all humans. It dominates everything. And John Maynard Keynes wrote about this, the great economist, 100 years ago. He wrote, by the year 2030, he said, and this is how brilliant John Maynard Keynes was, most people won't have to work, we'll be able to provide all the needs of the people. And he said, this is going to cause trauma for people originally, because they're going to, what are they going to do? Everything is hardwired for us to constantly be working. That's how we find meaning in our life. But there won't be any reason to work, and in a market system, there won't be any jobs. So we've got to come up with something different. He said, we'll do better eventually, humanity, but it's going to be a fundamentally radical change in our species.
And I don't want this to seem too esoteric. I mean, I don't want this to seem too fantastical, because it's not. Our book is not about, you know, like the nirvana of the future. I wish it was. We'll write that book next. But our book is about the practical transition that we are in. And people will still work. People will still work a lot. The problem is, will they work at things they want to work at? Will it be creative and meaningful and visionary? Or will it be desperate? And when you have an increasingly jobless economy, you have that prospect of desperation. And you have that prospect of not really seeing your way out. What we would argue is that we have we love the idea of free college education as far as you can go. But you know, we're going to offer you an odd notion here. Maybe you would follow that free college education because you actually want to learn stuff, because you actually want to be more knowledgeable and maybe come up with creative ideas. Maybe
the reason why rich people go to college.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe everyone could have that privilege just to study literature and art and music and history.
We have this radical notion. We think that technology, which we believe in and which we celebrate, we're not anti-technology. We may like the Luddites for some of their philosophy, but we're not anti-technology at all. But what we're saying is, you know, we think technology might just free us to all be like rich people, right? And why would we ever accept a social order in which it is accepted that some people don't have to work very much, can, you know, get all the education they want, can travel where they want, have all this flexibility, but the great mass of us, 99% of us, don't have any of it. What we're suggesting is we're moving into an age where there's going to be a lot more flexibility if we're at that table, if it is our future, not theirs. And this is the big choice that we're in. And this is, to us, it's the fundamental thing. It's exciting. It's thrilling. It's scary. But the bottom line is, we don't know what people will decide. But we do know that they better, A, be a part of the discussion, and B, they better be ready for this discussion. Because it's not a little tiny discussion anymore. We're not talking about Donald Trump's hands anymore. We're talking about the economic and social structures of the future, and we ought to be having some role in shaping them.
All right. We are just about out of time. If there's anything that either of you want to add in about a minute to finish off this conversation.
Well, I would say there's a lot in the book we have barely touched on, the vast majority. The thing I would say about this book, John and I have written several books together, and we've written lots of books independently, and we've had a certain measure of success. This is the first book we've written in which it's just coming out officially tomorrow. It's been in print for a couple of weeks. We sent out copies to a bunch of friends, and the initial people we don't know got copies. We've had several people already email us or write us and said they got a copy of the book. They just opened it and they couldn't put it down. They read it cover to cover. I've never had that before. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's sort of a striking transition. I think that this is a book that even no matter what your political views are, no what you're concerned, this goes really to the heart of the issues facing our country, people in this country, the young people especially, but really all of us. And it opens up a door I think we're going to have to all go through. And it's in our interest, as John said, that we go through it empowered to make change, not as passive spectators.
Robert McChesney and John Nichols, I want to thank you very much for coming into KBOO today right after your flight into Portland. Thank you so much for coming down and supporting us and writing this book, People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy. That's People Get Ready. And I want to mention again that Robert and John will be at Powell's City of Books on Burnside tonight at 7:30. You can get more questions answered there and talk with John and Robert. So thanks again to both of you.
Thank you so much.
It's our pleasure to be here.
And we will encourage listeners to support KBOO because in this future we imagine, we're going to need a lot of great community radio.
Thank you. This has been a special program today. Locus Focus will be returning soon. And this is Kathleen Stevenson for KBOO Public Affairs. Thanks to Kate for engineering. Stay tuned. Coming up, it's Health Watch with Dr. David Naiman.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Holistic Tracking, Engaging All Our Senses, an experiential weekend workshop taking place March 11th through 13th at the Cedar Ridge Retreat in Vernonia, Oregon. Holistic Tracking calls upon all senses, including the inner senses, to become a conscious part of the dynamic story of life on Earth. The workshop teaches effective observation, reading local tracks and signs to follow a trail, building stronger connections with wildlife and nature, and more. Again, that's Holistic Tracking, Engaging All Our Senses, a weekend workshop taking place March 11th through 13th at the Cedar Ridge Retreat in Vernonia, Oregon. A link to register and more information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And good morning. It is 11 a.m. on KBOO Portland. And yes, David Naiman is standing by for Health Watch, and that will be followed today at 11:30 by Madness Radio with host Will Hall. He interviews Jim van Oos, professor of psychiatry in Amsterdam and London, about his article on abolishing the term schizophrenia. Help support KBOO Community Radio by donating your car, truck, motorcycle, ATV, motorhome, trailer, boat, or other type of vehicle. We'll transform your car into resources for underserved and underdeserved communities. Free training, recording equipment, and great programming for all of KBOO's listeners. Donating your vehicle is easy. All you need to do is call our toll-free number and schedule a free, convenient pickup time. We can pick your car up nearly anywhere, even from the repair shop. Make sure you have the title to your vehicle. The tow facility will provide you with a